On 20th of October 2009, the Free University of Brussels hosted a conference on terrorism lists, executive powers, and human rights. The conference was organized by the European Centre for Constitutional and Human Rights and the Université Libre de Bruxelles, with the support of the Transnational Institute and of Statewatch, amongst other organizations. You are about to hear Tackling Terrorism Through Asset Freezing and Terrorist Designation, a speech delivered by Gilles de Kerchove, the EU Counterterrorism Coordinator.
Thanks a lot. So thank you first for inviting me. And what I will say is it's more with my hat of professor at this university, but with my background as EU counterterrorist coordinator. I think it would be probably useful to start by explaining a bit the system. And I have 25 minutes, right?
Yes, okay. Yes.
I'll go through three different points. First, some preliminary remarks. Then I will turn to the consequence, the lessons drawn by both the UN and the EU after many decisions of courts in several places in the world, among which Luxembourg, of course, and end up with some thought on the way forward. First, we need to understand very well the nature of what we are doing when we put a name on a list. It is an administrative measure. And the objective is, of course, to prevent someone from developing his terrorist activity. So it's a pressure that one puts on a person, on an individual, or an organization, and the pressure is meant to remain as long as the person has the intention to commit a terrorist attack. It is therefore not a criminal sanction. It is a purely administrative procedure, and the decision is supposed to be provisional. It entails the freezing of assets, a travel ban, and a ban for to sell arms. And therefore, the decision which leads to the listing of a person or an organization is not a judicial one. It's an administrative one and a political one. And I'll come back to the political dimension of this. It is based on very sensitive information, a lot of intelligence, very often information which are classified. And that brings an additional problem into the procedure. And it has to be somewhat confidential because you don't inform in advance a person that you will freeze his asset. Otherwise, she or the organization will move the money to another jurisdiction. But of course, since it has a very serious negative impact on a person's freedom and property, one needs to design adequate procedural safeguards. That's the first point. The second point is, and that's something which is very often raised, you do not freeze a lot of money. If one looks at the number of assets which are frozen, it's not impressive. That is true. But that does not mean that we should not keep this tool. By the way, in the UN, it's one of the few really effective tools that one has to enforce international law. Why is it still useful to use listing procedures? For political reasons. When you designate an organization, a group, you state clearly that it's not a political organization fighting for political objective. It's a criminal organization, a terrorist organization, and the symbolic value is not meaningless. If you look at the importance for the Colombians to designate the FARC and having Europe behind their fight, if you look at the Turks against the PKK or the Sri Lankans, and one may say a lot about what they did recently, but LTTE is an awful terrorist organization acting in Europe, like the PKK, by the way. Or if you look at probably the most dangerous in the world with Al-Qaeda, LET or JUD in Pakistan, having them on the list, UN list or EU list, has some meaning. That is political. Technically speaking, It facilitated the work of the security people, of course, police, criminal justice. And, you know, we have a definition of terrorism which is rather wide, and for some people too wide. It covers participation to a terrorist organization, incitement, public provocation, the use of internet to disseminate hatred, call for jihad and violence, training, recruitment, and so on. All this is much facilitated by having a reference to a clearly designated organization. That's the second point. The third point, and just a reminder, probably not useful, but still, you know, we have two systems in Europe based on two major UN Security Council resolutions. The first one is the UN listing based on a resolution which last week had 10 years of existence, was adopted in 1999. It's UN Security Council Resolution 1267. And we, the member states, have decided to implement the decision taken in New York in the context of this 1267 resolution, which target initially the Taliban and then Al-Qaeda and people in the group. Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda group, core group, and the Talibans. The member states have decided to implement collectively the decision in New York by tasking the Commission to transpose in the legal order of the community the decision taken in New York and therefore ensure their direct application in the European Union. This regulation, the basic regulation to organize this implementation, was adopted in the EU EC framework in 2002. So that's the first track, and it's limited to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The second one is based on the generic resolution adopted in 2001 after 9/11, which is UN Security Council Resolution 1373, which asks all the members of the UN to have an autonomous mechanism to list individuals and organizations linked with terrorism. And here again, our member states have decided to set up an EU mechanism and not having separate individual mechanism to do so. But because we only have the provision we have in the treaty, and if I remember well, Article 60, 301, 308 of the TEC, we can only freeze assets of what we call external terrorists and not terrorism operating within the European Union, which I would call internal terrorists. Therefore, ETA, the Basque terrorist organization, cannot as such be sanctioned by a freezing of its asset. The only consequence of putting an internal individual or internal organization on the EU list is that it trigger a sort of reinforced cooperation among the police, the law enforcement agencies in Europe, and the prosecutors in Europe. It involves more Europol, it involves more Eurojust. So it's just reinforced law enforcement cooperation. That does not mean that their asset won't be frozen, because based on 1373, all the members of the UN have a legal obligation to set up a legal regime which allows for freezing of assets. By the way, it's not done by all the member states. And I know some member states which do not have a legal base for administrative freezing. They use a judicial freezing or confiscation, which is not exactly adequate. Worth knowing, and sometimes it's not well known by third states, that we don't list on the EU autonomous list organizations or individuals which have already been listed in New York. And so we don't have a double listing for obvious reason. And third, it's a legal and a political process. We have conditions, of course, to put someone on the list, on organization, and we'll come to that. But even if someone meets all the criteria to be on the list, member states may still decide that it's not adequate to put an organization on the list just because there are secret discussions in order to have to change and to convince an organization to change its course of action. And I remember at least one case in Latin America where it was an obvious terrorist organization, but diplomatic efforts were made in order to convince them to give up. Okay. That's the background, the preliminary remarks. Let's then turn to the different challenges in court. And these were good news, and this has led us to change and improve significantly, probably not enough, significantly the procedure and the procedural safeguards. I think we have had something like 25 cases decided by the Court of First Instance or the Court of Justice since the start of these two listing process, both on the UN designation and the EU designation. And we still have, I think, something like 20 cases pending in Luxembourg, both in against the UN listing and the EU listing process. I just want to refer, but probably most of you know them, but that's interesting, the two main cases which prompted a significant change, the CADI decision of the Court of Justice related to the UN designation and the PMOI or UMPI decision based on the autonomous EU designation procedure. I will start with the UMPI because that's the first which was decided by the Court of First Instance in December 2006. The Court decided to annul the designation of PMOI, you know, it's People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, for lack of due process. And that has led us, and it was an excellent decision, by the way, led us to improve I think, seriously, the procedure for listing an individual or an organization within the European Union. We have, and I just mentioned some of the improvement, improved the notification of the person. Of course, that's a basic requirement. The person or the organization is to be informed of the designation, not before, as I said, because it would just be stupid, but the decision, and it should be provided by an explicit statement of the reason why he is put on the list. We send a letter, of course, if we know where the person is living, and if we don't have this information, we publish the information in the official journal of the European Community. As I said, we provide the person with a statement of the reason, which, of course, we will inform the person that he may challenge his designation and appeal to the council first in a sort of administrative procedure, and he may benefit from humanitarian exceptions, and he may, if we confirm the decision, go to the court. The Council now re-examine in depth, and we have a special working group within the Council which look at first the statement of reason. If the person challenged his designation, the Council will re-examine its decision on the basis of the argument provided and may take another decision. Then the person can, of course, go to the court, and we review every 6 months the whole list, all the designation. We have to readopt the list, which implies that we have to look at each and every cases. And of course, that leads to sometime delisting of a person or organization. I think that since 2002, we have delisted 20 person and six organizations, six groups. Interesting to note that the Court of First Instance in the OMPI 3 case on the 23rd of October 2007 found that the new procedure was fully consistent with the requirement of due process. And one may say today, I think, we'll see in the future, nobody can, of course, predict all that 100%, but the improvement that were decided after the OMPI 1 case are now considered by the court as meeting the requirement of due process. That's for the OMPI case. For the CADI case, which is there not based on the UN autonomous listing procedure, but on the UN procedure, you know that on the 3rd of September last year, the Court of Justice reversed the decision of the Court of First Instance in two linked cases, CADI and Al-Barakat International Foundation, and considered that the council had not respected the due process rights of the two applicants, especially right of defence. They had not been given the reason for their being listed and had not had the opportunity to challenge this decision. And therefore, it was not possible for them to exercise their right to an effective legal remedy. It was, of course, if you read the very long decision of the Court of First Instance, a difficult decision for the Court, because at the same time the Court rightly was trying to challenge the procedure on due process grounds, but was very eager not to enter into the review of the decision in New York, because the decision, the resolution is adopted on the basis of Chapter 7 of the Charter, which has a binding nature. So the reasoning is quite subtle, but I think it reached a quite reasonable compromise. What did we do? On the basis of that, the Commission tabled a draft amendment to the regulation of 2002 in order to, in a way, take the improvement that we had already decided for after the OMPI case, notification, statement of reason, review process, and all that mechanism, and import them when implementing the UN Security Council decision. This regulation has not been adopted yet. It's in co-decision with the European Parliament, and I don't know if it's co-decision, by the way. It's in the European Parliament at the moment, and I hope it will be adopted soon. But the Commission has already started implementing the procedure when receiving decision from New York. It entails a lot of problems, because that requires New York to provide the Commission with a lot of information so that the Commission may draft a statement of reason based on the narrative summary produced in New York. If one wants to follow the reasoning of the Court, one has to leave the Commission a margin of discretion, because if the Commission is only implementing automatically the decision in New York, we may be faced with problems in the Court of Justice. We had some discussion in the Council on whether we should task the Council to do the to take the decision or let the Commission doing that. That's quite a sensitive topic, because it implies that the Commission, the European Commission, gets access to intelligence, sensitive material, and you know how much our intelligence community is sensitive on that aspect. So that's the two main court decision and the improvement that were decided on the basis of this decision. One or two reflections on the way forward. You know that in New York, the initial 1267 procedure has been improved, not enough, of course, during the 10 years, through several UN Security Council resolutions. I won't go into the details, 1617, 1730, 1735, 1822, in order to slowly bring a bit more procedural safeguards. A focal point has been appointed within the Secretary of the UN in order to act as a go-between between the petitioner and the 1267 committee. Member states suggesting to put a name on the list have to provide more information, the basis for the listing, a narrative statement, information that can be released to the public and put on a website, and more accurate information on the person. And I'll come to this problem later on. The Secretary has to inform the permanent mission in New York, the mission of the origin of the resident of the targeted person or organization within 2 weeks. It has been reduced to 1 week, and so forth. And the most important resolution is the 1822, which has tasked the 1267 committee to review the consolidated list by next year, June 2010, and then to have an annual review of all the names if this name has not been looked at in the last 3 years. It's a challenge, and the 1267 committee is currently working on it. I think they have already reviewed 58 names, 43 have been confirmed, 4 delisted, and 11 are still pending. It's a challenge in relation to the first designation, what someone called once, rightly so, the toxic designation. That's the one which were decided just after 9/11, probably on the basis of weak element of information. We all know that in the aftermath of 9/11, the US came with CIA sometimes light information and put people on the list. It's a huge challenge for the 1267 committee now to come with solid arguments to keep this, and therefore it leads to delisting. I think that 43 have already been delisted, 19 individuals and 24 entities. We have had, we all remember the difficult case in Belgium of Patricia Ving and Nobil Sayadi, which were delisted in July 2009. There is another Italian which was challenging a decision by the Swiss authority, Youssef Nada. He went even to the court of Strasbourg, but he was delisted, I think, during the summer. It's a difficult exercise, and delisting remains a problem. And it's a bit sad, because in a way, if you remember what I said at the outset, it's a legal but a political exercise. And let's just take Afghanistan. If Karzai wants to find compromise with the Taliban, it's the decision up to him to decide, one of the requirements of the request of the Taliban is, of course, to get out of the list. And if one wants to do some negotiation in Kabul, you have to deliver then. But the decision to delist, so far, it's a unanimous decision of the member of the 1267. So only one member of the 1267 may oppose to it, which is, of course, a serious problem. So the first, my first point is some improvement have already been done, but of course not enough. We need to improve further the fairness of the listing procedure. Many proposals were made by some members of the UN, Denmark, Germany, Liechtenstein, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Sweden, I think Belgium was in the group, and Costa Rica. You have a lot of proposals, among which the Watson report, and most recently another one which I found extremely well drafted. The main proposal of all these initiatives is to create an independent review of the decision of the 1267, sort of either an especially constituted tribunal or a sort of ombudsman, a sort of impartial review panel, giving advice to the 1267, looking at the files and just giving an advice. It's probably unlikely to be adopted soon. Part of it because the permanent members of the UN Security Council do not want to see the binding nature of the decision of the UN Security Council challenged by an independent body. So I'm not that optimistic on that front. But I think there is a lot we can do to improve even further, without going as far as setting up a sort of ombudsman to review the decision of the 1267, we have to improve the procedure itself within 1267 for listing and delisting, and some good proposals are made in this context. And in addition to that, we have to improve the quality of the information on the basis of which a person or an organization is put on the list. If the names themselves, and sometimes they lack the necessary accurate identifiers, are not sufficiently precise and accurate, first, people with a similar name will be in trouble. It's difficult for the financial institution to take action. It's difficult for the border control to take action on the basis of inaccurate names. All this lead to a loss of public support, to something which may be criticized, but that in the first on its own merit has, I think, may play a useful role. And if it's difficult to remove someone from the list, you will see more and more members of the UN reluctant to suggest to add a name to the list. So what we need to do at least, save of having an individual panel review, is to produce a smaller and more accurate consolidated list. I think the more the list will be reliable, the more the narrative summary will be based on solid arguments, the more the European Court of Justice will abstain from reviewing the substance of the case. So far, the court has refrained from going into a really in-depth analysis of the merit of the case. It's a sort of marginal control. Sometimes the court of first instance look at the facts themselves. In the Assam case, one of the arguments was that the guy did something wrong in 2003, and he indicated in 2003 he was in jail, so it was not possible. So the facts on the basis of which the decision was taken was not accurate itself. So that's okay. And so among the proposals, you have a lot of ideas like giving a more active role to the monitoring team in collecting the information, in providing all the members of the 12CC7 with a very solid file, to increase the role of the focal point in New York, and several other steps in the procedure. I won't go into the details. I think we have to explore this. I will be myself next week in Washington talking to my opposite number in the State Department, because the UN Security Council will have to adopt a new resolution by the end of this year to renew the task of the monitoring team, and that's a perfect occasion to bring additional improvement to the procedure. But let's see what the new US administration is ready to accept. Finally, two or three challenges ahead. First, it's for our autonomous decision, but it applies for the UN as well, is the difference in Europe in the legal procedures on the basis of which one puts an individual or an organization on the list. I was myself involved in 2001 in the drafting of Article 3, Paragraph 4, or Article 1, 4, sorry, of the Common Position 931, which is a bit unclear for the simple reason that it just reflects the different organizations in Europe. On the continent, the police plays a much bigger role in all this, while on the UK side, it's more the intelligence community. And that explains why, and I'll read the text a bit long, but it says that the list shall be drawn up on the basis of precise information in the relevant file, which indicates that a decision has been taken by a competent authority in respect of the person, the group, and so on, of whether it concerned the instigation of investigation or prosecution of a terrorist act. And then the provision goes on and says, by competent authorities, we mean judicial authority, or where judicial authority have no competence in the area covered by this paragraph, an equivalent competent authority in that area. What is an equivalent competent authority? Is it an intelligence agency? That is something which is not that much clear. We've seen in the recent Cizon case that the decision of an agency looking at asylum request is not falling within the provision I just read. I think in the most recent OMPI case, the court considered that the prosecution by the French Tribunal de Grande Instance of Paris was not enough. And we will have in an Al-Aqsa case interesting development by the court on this topic. So that's the first one. The second one is the wish of the Court of Justice expressed in the last OMPI case, and against which the French made an appeal to the court, to get access to the whole file. That will create some difficulties, of course, because, as I said, it's a classified file with intelligence in it. And if we go that way, at some stage, I think it will be necessary to set up within the Court of Justice a sort of special chamber with special rules to allow the court to get access to confidential matter. So what are the next steps? And I'm coming to an end. In the 3-4 months ahead, trying to convince the Americans to get additional improvement in further than 1822 in the 1267 listing procedure. That's a first step. The second one is Lisbon, of course, because if you look at the Lisbon Treaty, in the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, you have two separate provisions. One in the special chapter on justice and home affairs, Article 75, which will allow the EU to freeze the asset of internal terrorists, the one I mentioned earlier, and an Article 215, which duplicate the current legal base, which allows the freezing of the asset of external terrorist or terrorist organization. Both provisions, first, will lead to a co-decision procedure with the European Parliament. That's a good news. And are extremely explicit on the need that the procedure entail, I have the text in French, but the necessary provisions in terms of procedural safeguards. So that's a good indication of the future. It will be up to the Commission to come in due time with the necessary proposal on that front. So that's a bit a summary of what we do and where we are. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to the talk given by Gilles de Kerchove, European Union Counterterrorism Coordinator, at the conference Terrorism Lists, Executive Powers and Human Rights, which was held on the 20th of October 2009 at the Free University of Brussels. For further information on human rights and the global state of exception, visit the Equipo Niscor website and look for the page that deals with this topic. The recording of this talk has been kindly provided by the European Centre for Constitutional and Human Rights. This audio document was produced on the 21st of July 2010 at Radio Niscor's Belgian studios.